keep her child safe. She was too valuable to kill, and if he abducted any of her descendants, she would no doubt goad him into killing her. But once she was isolated in America, with an infant to care for, she would learn submissiveness. Paths became occasional luxuries as they moved into country Anyanwu did not know. More and more, they had to use their machetes to clear the way. Streams became a problem. They flowed swiftly through deep gorges that had to be crossed somehow. Where the streams interrupted footpaths, local people had placed log bridges. But where Doro and Anyanwu found neither paths nor bridges, they had to cut their own logs. Travel became slower and more dangerous. A fall would not have killed either of them directly, but Doro knew that if he fell, he would not be able to stop himself from taking over Anyanwu's body. She was too close to him. On his way north, he had crossed several rivers by simply abandoning his body and taking over the body nearest to him on the far side. And since he was leading now, allowing his tracking sense to draw him to the crew aboard his ship, he could not send her ahead or leave her behind. He would not have wanted to anyway. They were in the country of people who waged war to get slaves to sell to the Europeans. These were people who would cut her to pieces if she began reshaping herself before them. Some of them even had European guns and powder. Their slow progress was not a complete waste of time, though. It gave him a chance to learn more about Anyanwu. And there was more to learn. He discovered that he would not have to steal food while she was with him. Once the two yams were roasted and eaten, she found food everywhere. Each day as they traveled, she filled her basket with fruit, nuts, roots, whatever she could find that was edible. She threw stones with the speed and force of a sling and brought down birds and small animals. At day's end, there was always a hearty meal. If a plant was unfamiliar to her, she tasted it and sensed within herself whether or not it was poison. She ate several things she said were poison, though none of them seemed to harm her. But she never gave him anything other than good food. He ate whatever she gave him, trusting her abilities. And when a small cut on his hand became infected, she gave him even more reason to trust her. The infected hand had begun to swell by the time she noticed it, and it was beginning to make him sick. He was already deciding how he would get a new body without endangering her. Then, to his surprise, she offered to help him heal.
"You should have told me," she said. "You let yourself suffer needlessly."
He looked at her doubtfully.
"Can you get the herbs you need out here?"
She met his eyes.
"Sometimes the herbs were for my people, like the gods in my compound. If you will let me, I can help you without them."
"All right."
He gave her his swollen, inflamed hand.
"There will be pain,"
she warned.
"All right," he repeated.
She bit his hand. He bore it, holding himself rigid against his own deadly reaction to sudden pain. She had done well to warn him. This was the second time she had been nearer to death than she could imagine. For a time after biting him, she did nothing. Her attention seemed to turn inward, and she did not answer when he spoke to her. Finally, she brought his hand to her mouth again, and there was more pain and pressure, but no more biting. She spat three times, each time returning to his hand. Then she seemed to caress the wound with her tongue. Her saliva burned like fire. After that, she kept a watch on the hand, attending it twice more with that startling, burning pain. Almost at once, the swelling and sickness went away, and the wound began to heal.
"There were things in your hand that should not have been there," she told him. "Living things too small to see. I have no name for them, but I can feel them and know them when I take them into my body. As soon as I know them, I can kill them within myself. I gave you a little of my body's weapon against them."
Tiny living things too small to see, but large enough to make him sick. If his wound had not begun to heal so quickly and cleanly, he would not have believed a word she said.
As it was, though, his trust in her grew. She was a witch, surely. In any culture, she would be feared. She would have to fight to keep her life. Even sensible people who did not believe in witches would turn against her. And Doro, breeder of witches that he was, realized all over again what a treasure she was. Nothing, no one, must prevent his keeping her. It was not until he reached one of his contacts near the coast that someone decided to try. Anyanwu never told Doro that she could jump all but the widest of the rivers they had to cross. She thought at first that he might guess because he had seen the strength of her hands. Her legs and thighs were just as powerful. But Doro was not used to thinking as she did about her abilities, not used to taking her strength or metamorphosing ability for granted. He never guessed, never asked what she could do. She kept silent because she feared that he too could leap the gorges, though in doing so, he might leave his body behind. She did not want to see him kill for so small a reason. She had listened to the stories he told as they traveled, and it seemed to her that he killed too easily, far too easily, unless the stories were lies. She did not think they were. She did not know whether he would take a life just to get across a river quickly, but she feared he might. This made her begin to think of escaping from him. It made her think longingly of her people, her compound, her home. Yet she made herself womanly for him at night. He never had to ask her to do this. She did it because she wanted to. Because in spite of her doubts and fears, he pleased her very much. She went to him as she had gone to her first husband, a man for whom she had cared deeply. And to her surprise, Doro treated her much as her first husband had. He listened with respect to her opinions and spoke with respect and friendship as though to another man. Her first husband had taken much secret ridicule for treating her this way. Her second husband had been arrogant, contemptuous, and brutal. Yet he had been considered a great man. She had run away from him as she now wished to run away from Doro. Doro could not have known what dissimilar men he brought alive in her memory. He had still given her no proof of the power he claimed, no proof that her children would be in danger from other than an ordinary man if she managed to escape. Yet she continued to believe him. She could not bring herself to get up while he slept and vanish into the forest. For her children's sake, she had to stay with him, at least until she had proof one way or the other. She followed him almost grimly, wondering what it would be like finally to be married to a man she could neither escape nor outlive. The prospect made her cautious and gentle. Her earlier husbands would not have known her. She sought to make him value her and care for her. Thus, she might have some leverage with him, some control over him later when she needed it. Much married as she was, she knew she would eventually need it. They were in the lowlands now, passing through wetter country. There was more rain, more heat, many more mosquitoes. Doro got some disease and coughed and coughed, and Yanwu got a fever but drove it out of herself as soon as she sensed it. There was enough misery to be had without sickness.
"When do we pass through this land?"
she asked in disgust. It was raining now. They were on someone's pathway laboring through sucking, ankle-deep mud.
"There is a river not far ahead of us," he told her.
He stopped for a moment to cough.
"I have an arrangement with people at a riverside town. They will take us the rest of the way by canoe."
"Strangers," she said with alarm. They had managed to avoid contact with most of the people whose lands they had crossed.
"You will be the stranger here," Doro told her. "But you need not worry. These people know me. I have given them gifts, dash, they call it, and promised them more if they rowed my people down the river."
"Do they know you in this body?"
she asked, using the question as an excuse to touch the hard, flat muscle of his shoulder. She liked to touch him.
"They know me," he said. "I am not the body I wear, Anyanwu. You will understand that when I change. Soon, I think. He paused for another fit of coughing. You will know me in another body as soon as you hear me speak.
How?
She did not want to talk about his changing, his killing. She had tried to cure his sickness so that he would not change. But though she had eased his coughing, prevented him from growing sicker, she had not made him well. That meant she might soon be finding out more about his changing, whether she wanted to or not.
How will I know you?
She asked. There are no words for me to tell you, as with your tiny living things. When you hear my voice, you will know me. That's all.
Will it be the same voice?
No.
Then how?
Anyanwu. He glanced around at her. I am telling you, you will know. Startled, she kept silent. She believed him. How was it? She always believed him. The village he took her to was a small place that seemed not much different from the waterside communities she had known nearer home. Here, some of the people stared at her in Doro, but no one molested them. She heard speech here and there, and sometimes it had a familiar sound to it. She thought she might understand a little if she could go closer to the speakers and listen. As it was, she understood nothing. She felt exposed, strangely helpless among people so alien. She walked closely behind Doro. He led her to a large compound, and into that compound as though it belonged to him. A tall, lean young man confronted him at once. The young man spoke to Doro, and when Doro answered, the young man's eyes widened. He took a step backward. Doro continued to speak in the strange language, and Anyanwu discovered that she could understand a few words, but not enough to follow the conversation. This language was at least more like her own than the new speech, the English, Doro was teaching her. English was one of the languages spoken in his homeland, he had told her. She had to learn it. Now, though, she gathered what she could from the unspoken language of the two men, from their faces and voices. It was obvious that instead of the courteous greeting Doro had expected, he was getting an argument from the young man. Finally, Doro turned away in disgust. He spoke to Anyanwu. The man I dealt with before has died, he told her. This fool is his son. He stopped to cough. The son was present when his father and I bargained. He saw the gifts I brought, but now that his father has died, he feels no obligation to me. I think he fears you, Anyanwu said. The young man was blustering and arrogant. That she could see despite the different languages. He was trying hard to seem important. As he spoke, though, his eyes shifted and darted and looked at Doro only in brief glances. His hands shook. He knows he is doing a dangerous thing, Doro said. But he is young. His father was a king. Now the son thinks he will use me to prove himself. He has chosen a poor target. Have you promised him more gifts? Yes, but he sees only my empty hands. Move away from me, Anyanwu. I have no more patience. She wanted to protest, but her mouth was suddenly dry. Frightened and silent, she stumbled backward away from him. She did not know what to expect, but she was certain the young man would be killed. How would he die? Exactly what would Doro do? Doro stepped past the young man and toward a boy child of about 7 years who had been watching the man talk. Before the young man or the child could react, Doro collapsed. His body fell almost on top of the boy, but the child jumped out of the way in time. Then he knelt on the ground and took Doro's machete. People were beginning to react as the boy stood up and leaned on the machete. The sounds of their questioning voices and their gathering around almost drowned out the child's voice when he spoke to the young man. Almost. The child spoke calmly, quietly in his own language, but as Anyanwu heard him, she thought she would scream aloud. The child
was Doro. There was no doubt of it. Doro's spirit had entered the child's body. And what had happened to the child's spirit? She looked at the body lying on the ground. Then she went to it, turned it over. It was dead.
"What have you done?"
she said to the child.
"This man knew what his arrogance could cost,"
Doro said, and his voice was high and childlike. There was no sound of the man Doro had been, and Yanwu did not understand what she was hearing, what she was recognizing in the boy's voice.
"Keep away from me,"
Doro told her.
"Stay there with the buddy until I know how many others of his household this fool was sacrificed to his arrogance."
She wanted nothing more than to keep away from him. She wanted to run home and try to forget she had ever seen him. She lowered her head and closed her eyes, fighting panic. There was shouting around her, but she hardly heard it. Intent on her own fear, she paid no attention to anything else until someone knocked her down. Then someone seized her roughly, and she realized she was to pay for the death of the child. She thrust her attacker away from her and leaped to her feet, ready to fight.
"That is enough,"
Doro shouted, and then more quietly,
"Do not kill him."
She saw that the person she had thrust away was the young man, and that she had pushed him harder than she thought. Now he was sprawled against the compound wall, half conscious. Doro went to him, and the man raised his hands as though to deflect a blow. Doro spoke to him in quiet, chilling tones that should never have issued from the mouth of a child. The man cringed, and Doro spoke again, more sharply. The man stood up, looked at the people of the household he had inherited from his father. They were clearly alarmed and confused. Most had not seen enough to know what was going on, and they seemed to be questioning each other. They stared at the new head of their household. There were several young children, women, some of whom must have been wives or sisters of the young man, men who were probably brothers and slaves. Everyone had come to see. Perhaps the young man felt that he had shamed himself before his people. Perhaps he was thinking about how he had cringed and whimpered before a child. Or perhaps he was merely the fool Doro took him to be. Whatever his reasoning, he made a fatal error. With shouted words that had to be curses, the man seized the machete from Doro's hand, raised it, and brought it slashing down through the neck of the unresisting child body. Anyanwu looked away, absolutely certain of what would happen. There had been ample time for the child to avoid the machete. The young man, perhaps still groggy from Anyanwu's blow, had not moved very quickly. But the child had stood still and awaited the blow with a shrug of adult weariness. Now she heard the young man speaking to the crowd, and she could hear Doro in his voice. "Of course." The people fled. Several of them ran out of the compound door or scrambled over the wall. Doro ignored them, went to Anyanwu.
"We will leave now," he said. "We will take a canoe and row ourselves."
"Why did you kill the child?"
she whispered.
"To warn this young fool," he said, hitting the chest of his lean, new body. "The boy was the son of a slave and no great loss to the household. I wanted to leave a man here who had authority and who knew me, but this man would not learn. Come, Anyanwu."
She followed him dumbly. He could turn from two casual murders and speak to her as though nothing had happened. He was clearly annoyed that he had had to kill the young man, but annoyance seemed to be all he felt. Beyond the walls of the compound, armed men waited. Anyanwu slowed, allowed Doro to move well ahead of her as he approached them. She was certain there would be more killing. But Doro spoke to the men, said only a few words to them, and they drew back out of his path. Then Doro made a short speech to everyone, and the people drew even farther away from him. Finally, he led Anyanwu down the river, where they stole a canoe and paddles.
"You must row,"
she told him, as they put the craft into the water.
"I will try to help you when we are beyond sight of this place."
Have you never rowed a canoe?
Not perhaps 3 times as long as this new body of yours has been alive.
He nodded and paddled the craft alone.
You should not have killed the child, she said sadly. It was wrong, no matter why you did it.
Your own people kill children.
Only the ones who must be killed, the abominations. And even with them, sometimes when the thing wrong with the child was small, I was able to stop the killing. I spoke with the voice of the god, and as long as I did not violate tradition too much, the people listened.
Killing children is wasteful, he agreed. Who knows what useful adults they might have grown into, but still, sometimes a child must be sacrificed.
She thought of her sons and their children, and knew positively that she had been right to get Doro away from them. Doro would not have hesitated to kill some of them, to intimidate others. Her descendants were ordinarily well able to take care of themselves, but they could not have stopped Doro from killing them, from walking about obscenely clothed in their flesh. What could stop such a being? A spirit. He was a spirit, no matter what he said. He had no flesh of his own. Not for the first time in her 300 years, Anyanwu wished she had gods to pray to, gods who would help her. But she had only herself and the magic she could perform with her own body. What good was that against a being who could steal her body away from her? And what would he feel if he decided to sacrifice her? Annoyance? Regret? She looked at him and was surprised to see that he was smiling. He took a deep breath and let it out with apparent pleasure.
"You need not row for a while," he told her. "Rest. This body is strong and healthy. It is so good not to be coughing."
Chapter 3 Doro was always in a good mood after changing bodies, especially when he changed more than once in quick succession, or when he changed to one of the special bodies that he bred for his use. This time, his pleasurable feelings were still with him when he reached the coast. He noticed that Anyanwu had been very quiet, but she had her quiet times, and she had just seen a thing that was new to her. Doro knew people took time to get used to his changes. Only his children seemed to accept them naturally. He was willing to give Anyanwu all the time she needed. There were slavers on the coast. An English factor lived there, an employee of the Royal African Company, and incidentally, Doro's man. Bernard Daly was his name. He had 3 black wives, several half-breed children, and apparently strong resistance to the numerous local diseases. He also had 1 hand. Years before, Doro had cut off the other. Daly was supervising the branding of new slaves when Doro and Anyanwu pulled their canoe onto the beach. There was a smell of cooking flesh in the air and the sound of a slave boy screaming.
"Doro, this is an evil place," Anyanwu whispered.
She kept very close to him.
"No one will harm you," he said.
He looked down at her. She always spent her days as a small, muscular man, but somehow he could never think of her as masculine. He had asked her once why she insisted on going about as a man.
"I have not seen you going about in women's bodies," she retorted. "People will think before they attack a man, even a small man, and they will not become as angry if a man gives them a beating."
He had laughed, but he knew she was right. She was somewhat safer as a man, although here, among African and European slavers, no one was truly safe. He himself might be forced out of his new body before he could reach Daly, but Anyanwu would not be touched. He would see to it.
"Why do we stop here?" she asked. "I have a man here who might know what happened to my people, the people I came to get. This is the nearest seaport to them."
"Seaport," she repeated the word as he had said it, in English. He did not know the word in her language for sea.
He had described to her the wide, seemingly endless water that they had to cross, but in spite of his description, she stared at it in silent awe. The sound of the surf seemed to frighten her as it mixed with the screaming of slaves being branded. For the first time, she looked as though the many strange new things around her would overwhelm her. She looked as though she would turn and run back into the forest, as slaves often tried to do. Completely out of character, she looked terrified. He stopped, faced her, took her firmly by the shoulders.
"Nothing will harm you, Anyanwu."
He spoke with utter conviction.
"Not these slavers, not the sea, not anything at all. I have not brought you all this way, only to lose you. You know my power."
He felt her shudder.
"That power will not harm you either. I have accepted you as my wife. You have only to obey me."
She stared at him as he spoke, as though these eyes of hers could read his expression and discern truth. Ordinary people could not do that with him, but she was far from ordinary. She had had time enough in her long life to learn to read people well, as Doro himself had learned. Some of his people believed he could read their unspoken thoughts, so transparent were their lies to him. Half-truths, though, could be another matter. Anyanwu seemed to relax, reassured. Then something off to one side caught her eye, and she stiffened.
"Is that one of your white men?"
she whispered. He had told her about Europeans, explaining that in spite of their pale skins, they were neither albinos nor lepers. She had heard of such people, but had not seen any until now. Doro glanced at the approaching European, then spoke to Anyanwu.
"Yes," he said. "But he is only a man. He can die as easily as a black man. Move away from me."
She obeyed quickly. Doro did not intend to kill the white man if he could avoid it. He had killed enough of Daly's people back at their first meeting to put the Englishman out of business. Daly had proved tractable, however, and Doro had helped him to survive.
"Welcome," the white man said in English. "Have you more slaves to sell us?"
Clearly, Doro's new body was no stranger here. Doro glanced at Anyanwu, saw how she was staring at the slaver. The man was bearded and dirty and thin, as though wasted by disease, which was likely. This land swallowed white men. The slaver was a poor example of his kind, but Anyanwu did not know that. She was having a good look. Her curiosity now seemed stronger than her fear.
"Are you sure you know me?"
Doro asked the man quietly, and his voice had the expected effect. The man stopped, frowned in confusion and surprise.
"Who are you?"
he demanded.
"Who? What do you want here?"
He was not afraid. He did not know Doro. He merely assumed he had made a mistake. He stood peering up at the tall black man and projecting hostility.
"I'm a friend of Bernard Daly," Doro said. "I have business with him."
Doro spoke in English, as did the slaver, and there was no doubt that the man understood him. Thus, when the slaver continued to stare, Doro started past him, walked toward the branding where he could see Daly talking with someone else. But the slaver was not finished. He drew his sword.
"You want to see the captain?"
he said. Daly had not been master of a ship for 15 years, but he still favored the title. The slaver grinned at Doro, showing a scattering of yellow teeth.
"You'll see him soon enough."
Doro glanced at the sword, annoyed. In a single movement, almost too swift to follow, he raised his heavy machete and knocked the lighter weapon from the slaver's hand. Then the machete was at the man's throat.
"That could have been your hand," Doro said softly.
"It could have been your head." "My people would kill you where you stand."
"What good would that do you?"
"In hell."
Silence.
"Turn, and we'll go see Daly."
The slaver obeyed hesitantly, muttering some obscenity about Doro's ancestry.
"Another word will cost you your head," Doro said. Again, there was silence.
The three marched single file past the chained slaves, past the fire where the branding had stopped, past Daly's men who stared at them. They went to the tree-shaded, three-sided shelter where Daly sat on a wooden crate, drinking from an earthen jug. He lowered the jug, though, to stare at Doro and Anyanwu.
"I see business is good," Doro said.
Daly stood up. He was short and square and sunburned and unshaven.
"Speak again," he growled. "Who are you?"
He was a little hard of hearing, but Doro thought he had heard enough. Doro could see in him the strange combination of apprehension and anticipation that Doro had come to expect from his people. He knew when they greeted him this way that they were still his servants, loyal and tame.
"You know me," he said.
The slaver took a step back.
"I've left your man alive," Doro said.
"Teach him manners."
"I will."
He waved the confused, angry man away. The man glared at Doro and at the now lowered machete. Finally, he stalked away. When he was gone, Doro asked Daly,
"Has my crew been here?"
"More than once," the slaver said. "Just yesterday, your son Lael chose two men and three women. Strong young blacks they were. Worth much more than I charged."
"I'll soon see," Doro said.
Suddenly, Anyanwu screamed. Doro glanced at her quickly to see that she was not being molested. Then he kept his eyes on Daly and on his men.
"Woman, you will cause me to make a mistake," he muttered.
"It is Okoye," she whispered. "The son of my youngest daughter. These men must have raided her village."
"Where is he?"
"There."
She gestured toward a young man who had just been branded. He lay on the ground, dirty, winded, and bruised from his struggles to escape the hot iron.
"I will go to him," Anyanwu said softly, "though he will not know me."
"Go,"
Doro told her. Then he switched back to English.
"I may have more business for you, Daly.
That boy."
"But that one is taken. A company ship."
"A pity," Doro said. "The profit will not be yours, then."
The man raised his stump to rub his hairy chin.
"What are you offering?"
It was his habit to supplement his meager salary by trading with interlopers, non-company men, like Doro. Especially Doro. It was a dangerous business, but England was far away and he was not likely to be caught.
"One moment,"
Doro told him, then switched languages.
"Anyanwu, is the boy alone or are there other members of your family here?"
"He is alone. The others have been taken away."
"When?"
She spoke briefly with her grandson, then faced Doro again.
"The last ones were sold to white men many days ago."
Doro sighed. That was that, then. The boy's relatives, strangers to him, were even more completely lost than the people of his seed village. He turned and made Daly an offer for the boy, an offer that caused the slaver to lick his lips. He would give up the boy without coercion and find some replacement for whoever had bought him. The blackened, cooked gouge on the boy's breast had become meaningless.
"Unchain him,"
Doro ordered. Daly gestured to one of his men, and that man removed the chains.
"I'll send one of my men back with the money,"
Doro promised. Daly shook his head and stepped out of the shelter.
"I'll walk with you,"
he said.
"It isn't far. One of your people might shoot you if they see you looking that way with only two more blacks as companions."
Doro laughed and accepted the man's company. He wanted to talk to Daly about the seed village anyway.
"Do you think I'll cheat you?"
he asked. "After all this time?" Daly smiled, glanced back at the boy who walked with Anyanwu.
"You could cheat me," he said. "You could rob me whenever you choose, and yet you pay well. Why?"
"Perhaps because you are wise enough to accept what you cannot understand."
"You?"
"Me. What do you tell yourself I am?"
"I used to think you were the devil himself."
Doro laughed again. He had always permitted his people the freedom to say what they thought, as long as they stopped when he silenced them and obeyed when he commanded them. Daly had belonged to him long enough to know this.
"Who are you, then?"
he asked the slaver.
"Job?"
"No."
Daly shook his head sadly.
"Job was a stronger man."
Doro stopped, turned, and looked at him.
"You are content with your life," he said.
Daly looked away, refusing to meet whatever looked through the very ordinary eyes of the body Doro wore. But when Doro began to walk again, Daly followed. He would follow Doro to his ship, and if Doro himself offered payment for the young slave, Daly would refuse to take it. The boy would become a gift. Daly had never taken money from Doro's hand, and always he had sought Doro's company.
"Why does the white animal follow?"
asked Anyanwu's grandson loudly enough for Doro to hear.
"What has he to do with us now?"
"My master must pay him for you,"
said Anyanwu. She had presented herself to the boy as a distant kinsman of his mother.
"And also," she added, "I think this man serves him somehow."
"If the white man is a slave, why should he be paid?"
Doro answered this himself.
"Because I choose to pay him, Okoye. A man may choose what he will do with his slaves."
"Do you send your slaves to kill our kinsmen and steal us away?"
"No,"
Doro said.
"My people only buy and sell slaves."
And only certain slaves at that, if Daly was obeying him. He would know soon.
"Then they sent others to prey on us. It is the same thing."
"What I permit my people to do is my affair,"
Doro said.
"But they—"
Doro stopped abruptly, turned to face the young man who was himself forced to come to an awkward stop.
"What I permit them to do is my affair, Okoye. That is all."
Perhaps the boy's enslavement had taught him caution. He said nothing. Anyanwu stared at Doro, but she too kept silent.
"What were they saying?"
Daly asked.
"They disapprove of your profession,"
Doro told him.
"Heathen savages," Daly muttered. "They're like animals. They're all cannibals."
"These aren't," Doro said. "Though some of their neighbors are."
"All of them," Daly insisted. "Just give them the chance."
Doro smiled.
"Well, no doubt the missionaries will reach them eventually and teach them to practice only symbolic cannibalism."
Daly jumped. He considered himself a pious man in spite of his work.
"You shouldn't say such things," he whispered. "Not even you are beyond the reach of God."
"Spare me your mythology," Doro said, "and your righteous indignation."
Daly had been Doro's man too long to be pampered in such matters.
"At least we cannibals are honest about what we do," Doro continued. "We don't pretend as your slavers do to be acting for the benefit of our victims' souls. We don't tell ourselves we've caught them to teach them civilized religion."
Daly's eyes grew round.
"But I did not mean you were I did not mean—"
"Why not?"
Doro looked down at him, enjoying his confusion.
"I assure you, I'm the most efficient cannibal you will ever meet."
Daly said nothing. He wiped his brow and stared seaward. Doro followed his gaze and saw that there was a ship in sight now, lying at anchor in a little cove. Doro's own ship, the Silver Star, small and hardy, and more able than any of his larger vessels to go where it was not legally welcome, and take on slave cargo the Royal African Company had reserved for itself. Doro could see some of his men a short distance away, loading yams onto a longboat. He would be on his way home, soon. Doro invited Daly out to the ship. There, he first settled Anyanwu and her grandson in his own cabin. Then he ate and drank with Daly, and questioned the slaver about the seed village. "Not a coastal people," Doro said. "An inland tribe from the grasslands beyond the forests. I showed you a few of them years ago when we met."
"These blacks are all alike," Daly said. "It's hard to tell."
He took a swallow of brandy. Doro reached across the small table and grasped Daly's wrist just above the man's sole remaining hand.
"If you can't do better than that," he said, "you're no good to me."
Daly froze, terrified, arresting a sudden effort to jerk his hand away. He sat still, perhaps remembering how his men had died years before, whether Doro touched them or not.
"It was a joke," he whispered hoarsely.
Doro said nothing, only looked at him.
"Your people have Arab blood," Daly said quickly. "I remember their looks and the words of their language that you taught me, and their vile tempers. Not an easy people to enslave and keep alive. None like them have gone through my hands without being tested."
"Speak the words I taught you."
Daly spoke them. Words in the seed people's own language, asking them whether they were followers of Doro, whether they were Doro's seed. And Doro released Daly's wrist. The slaver had said the words perfectly, and none of Doro's seed villagers had failed to respond. They were, as Daly had said, difficult people. Bad-tempered, more suspicious than most of strangers, more willing than most to murder each other or attack their far-flung neighbors, more willing to satisfy their customs and their meat-hunger with human flesh. Doro had isolated them on their sparsely populated savanna for just that reason. Had they been any closer to the larger, stronger tribes around them, they would have been wiped out as a nuisance. They were also a highly intuitive people, who involuntarily saw into each other's thoughts and fought with each other over evil intentions rather than evil deeds. This without ever realizing that they were doing anything unusual. Doro had been their god since he had assembled them generations before and commanded them to marry only each other and the strangers he brought to them. They had obeyed him, throwing away clearly defective children born of their inbreeding, and strengthening the gifts that made them so valuable to him. If those same gifts made them abnormally quick to anger, vicious, and savagely intolerant of people unlike themselves, it did not matter. Doro had been very pleased with them, and they had long ago accepted the idea that pleasing him was the most important thing they could do.
"Your people are surely dead if they have been taken," Daly said. "The few that you brought here with you years ago made enemies wherever they went."
Doro had brought five of the villagers out to crossbreed them with certain others he had collected. They had insulted everyone with their arrogance and hostility, but they had also bred as Doro commanded them and gotten fine children. Children with ever greater, more controllable sensitivity.
"Some of them are alive," Doro said. "I can feel their lives drawing me when I think of them. I'm going to have to track as many of them as I can before someone does kill them, though."
"I'm sorry," Daly said. "I wish they had been brought to me. As bad as they are, I would have held them for you."
Doro nodded, sighed.
"Yes, I know you would have."
And the last of the slaver's tension melted away. He knew Doro did not blame him for the seed people's demise, knew he would not be punished.
"What is that little Igbo you have brought aboard?"
he asked curiously. There was room for curiosity now.
"Wild seed," Doro said. "Carrier of a bloodline I believed was lost, and I think of another that I did not know existed,
I have some exploring to do in her homeland once she is safely away.
She? But that black is a man.
Sometimes. But she was born a woman. She is a woman most of the time.
Daly shook his head, unbelieving.
The monstrosities you collect.
I suppose now you will breed creatures who don't know whether to piss standing or squatting.
They will know, if I can breed them. They will know, but it won't matter.
Such things should be burned. They are against God.
Doro laughed and said nothing. He knew as well as Daly how the slaver longed to be one of Doro's monstrosities. Daly was still alive because of that desire. 10 years before, he had confronted what he considered to be just another black savage, leading 5 other less black but equally savage-looking men. All 6 men appeared to be young, healthy, fine potential slaves. Daly had sent his own black employees to capture them. He had lost 13 men that day. He had seen them swept down as grain before a scythe. Then, terrified, confronted by Doro in the body of the last man killed, he had drawn his own sword. The move cost him his right hand. He never understood why it had not cost him his life. He did not know of Doro's habit of leaving properly disciplined men of authority scattered around the world, ready to serve whenever Doro needed them. All Daly understood was that he had been spared, that Doro had cauterized his wound and cared for him until he recovered. And by the time he recovered, he had realized that he was no longer a free man, that Doro was capable of taking the life he had spared at any time. Daly was able to accept this, as others had accepted it before him.
"Let me work for you," he had said. "Take me aboard one of your ships, or even back to your homeland. I'm still strong. Even with one hand, I can work. I can handle blacks."
"I want you here," Doro had told him. "I've made arrangements with some of the local kings while you are recovering. They'll trade with you exclusively from now on." Daly had stared at him in amazement.
"Why would you do such a thing for me?"
"So that you can do a few things for me," Doro had answered. And Daly had been back in business. Doro sent him black traders who sold him slaves, and his company sent him white traders who bought them. "Someone else would set up a factory here if you left," Doro told him. "I can't stop the trade even where it might touch my people, but I can control it." So much for his control. Neither his support of Daly nor his spies left along the coast, people who should have reported to Daly, had been enough. Now they were useless. If they had been special stock, people with unusual abilities, Doro would have resettled them in America, where they could be useful. But they were only ordinary people bought by wealth or fear or belief that Doro was a god. He would forget them. He might forget Daly also, once he had returned to Anyanwu's homeland and sought out as many of her descendants as he could find. At the moment, though, Daly could still be useful, and he could still be trusted. Doro knew that now. Perhaps the seed people had been taken to Bani or New Calabar or some other slave port, but they had not passed near Daly. The most talented and deceptive of Doro's own children could not have lied to him successfully while he was on guard. Also, Daly had discovered he enjoyed being an arm of Doro's power.
"Now that your people are gone," Daly said, "why not take me to Virginia or New York, where you have blacks working? I'm sick to death of this country."
"Stay here," Doro ordered. "You can still be useful. I'll be coming back."
"I almost wish I was one of those strange beings you call your people," he admitted.
Doro smiled and had the ship's captain, John Woodley, pay for the boy, Okoye, and send Daly ashore.
"Slimy little bastard," Woodley muttered when Daly was gone.
Doro said nothing. Woodley, one of Doro's ordinary, ungifted sons, had always disliked Daly. This amused Doro, since he considered the two men much alike. Woodley was the child of a casual liaison Doro had had 45 years before with a London merchant's daughter. Doro had married the woman and provided for her when he learned she would bear his child, but he quickly left her a widow, well off, but alone except for her infant son. Doro had seen John Woodley twice as the boy grew toward adulthood. When on the second visit, Woodley expressed a desire to go to sea, Doro had him apprenticed to one of Doro's shipmasters. Woodley had worked his own way up. He could have become wealthy, could be commanding a great ship instead of one of Doro's smallest, but he had chosen to stay near Doro. Like Daly, he enjoyed being an arm of Doro's power. And like Daly, he was envious of others who might outrank him in Doro's esteem.
"That little heathen would sail with you today if you'd let him," Woodley told Doro. "He's no better than one of his blacks. I don't see what good he is to you."
"He works for me," Doro said. "Just as you do."
"It's not the same."
Doro shrugged and let the contradiction stand. Woodley knew better than Daly ever could just how much it was the same. He'd worked too closely with Doro's most gifted children to overestimate his own value. And he knew the living generations of Doro's sons and daughters would populate a city. He knew how easily both he and Daly could be replaced. After a moment, he sighed as Daly had sighed.
"I suppose the new blacks you brought aboard have some special talent," he said.
"That's right," Doro answered. "Something new."
"Godless animals,"
Woodley muttered bitterly. He turned and walked away. Chapter 4 The ship frightened Anyanwu, but it frightened Okoye more. He had seen that the men aboard were mostly white men, and in his life he had had no good experiences with white men. Also, fellow slaves had told him the whites were cannibals.
"We will be taken to their land and fattened and eaten," he told Anyanwu.
"No,"
Anyanwu assured him.
"It is not their custom to eat men, and if it were, our master would not permit us to be eaten. He is a powerful man."
Okoye shuddered.
"He is not a man."
Anyanwu stared at him. How had he discovered Doro's strangeness so quickly?
"It was he who bought me, then sold me to whites. I remember him. He beat me. It is the same face, the same skin, but something different is living inside. Some spirit."
"Okoye." Anyanwu spoke very softly and waited until he turned from his terrified gazing into space and looked at her.
"If Doro is a spirit," she said, "then he has done you a service. He has killed your enemy for you. Is that reason to fear him?"
"You fear him yourself. I have seen it in your eyes."
Anyanwu gave him a sad smile.
"Not as much as I should, perhaps."
"He is a spirit."
"You know I am your mother's kinsman, Okoye."
He stared at her for a time without answering. Finally, he asked,
"Have her people also been enslaved?"
"Not when I last saw them."
"Then how were you taken?"
"Do you remember your mother's mother?"
"She is the oracle. The god speaks through her."
"She is Anyanwu, your mother's mother,"
Anyanwu said.
"She fed you pounded yam and healed the sickness that threatened to take your life. She told you stories of the tortoise, the monkey, the birds. And sometimes when you looked at her in the shadows of the fire and the lamp, it seemed to you that she became these creatures. You were frightened at first, then you were pleased. You asked for the stories and the changes. You wanted to change too."
"I was a child," Okoye said. "I was dreaming."
"You were awake."
"You cannot know."
"I know."
"I never told anyone."
"I never thought you would," Anyanwu said. Even as a child, you seem to know when to talk and when to keep quiet."
She smiled, remembering the small, stoic boy who had refused to cry with the pain of his sickness, who had refused to smile when she told him the old fables her mother had told her. Only when she startled him with her changes did he begin to pay attention. She spoke softly.
"Do you remember, Okoye, your mother's mother had a mark here?"
She drew with her finger the jagged old scar that she had once carried beneath her left eye. As she drew it, she aged and furrowed the flesh so that the scar appeared. Okoye bolted toward the door. Anyanwu caught him, held him easily in spite of his greater size and his desperate strength.
"What am I that I was not before?"
she asked, when the violence had gone out of his struggles.
"You are a man?"
he gasped.
"Or a spirit?"
"I am no spirit," she said. "And should it be so difficult for a woman who can become a tortoise or a monkey to become a man?"
He began to struggle again. He was a young man now, not a child. The easy childhood acceptance of the impossible was gone, and she dared not let him go. In his present state, he might jump into the water and drown.
"If you will be still, Okoye, I will become the old woman you remember."
Still, he struggled.
"Nwadiani, daughter's child, do you remember that even the pain of sickness could not make you weep when your mother brought you to me? But you wept because you could not change as I could?"
He stopped his struggles, stood gasping in her grip.
"You are my daughter's son," she said. "I would not harm you."
He was still now, so she released him. The bond between a man and his mother's kin was strong and gentle. But for the boy's own safety, she kept her body between his and the door.
"Shall I become as I was?" she asked.
"Yes," the boy whispered.
She became an old woman for him. The shape was familiar and easy to slip into. She had been an old woman for so long.
"It is you,"
Okoye said wonderingly. She smiled.
"You see, why should you fear an old woman?"
To her surprise, he laughed.
"You always had too many teeth to be an old woman, and strange eyes. People said the god looked out of your eyes."
"What do you think?"
He stared at her with great curiosity, walked around her to look at her.
"I am not his slave."
"I cannot see how any man would hold you in slavery. What are you?"
"His wife."
The boy stared speechless at her long breasts.
"I am not this wrinkled woman, Okoye. I allowed myself to become her when my last husband, the father of your mother, died. I thought I had had enough husbands and enough children. I am older than you can imagine. I wanted to rest. When I had rested for many years as the people's oracle, Doro found me. In his way, he is as different as I am. He wanted me to be his wife."
"But he is not merely different. He is something other than a man."
"And I am something other than a woman."
"You are not like him."
"No, but I have accepted him as my husband. It was what I wanted, to have a man who was as different from other men as I am from other women."
If this was not entirely true, Okoye did not need to know.
"Show me."
Okoye paused as though not certain of what he wanted to say.
"Show me what you are."
Obligingly, she let her true shape flow back to her, became the young woman whose body had ceased to age when she was about 20 years old. At 20, she had a violent, terrible sickness, during which she had heard voices, felt pain in one part of her body after another, screamed and babbled in foreign dialects. Her young husband had feared she would die. She was a Nasi, his first wife, and though she was in disfavor with his family, because after 5 years of marriage she had produced no children, he fought hard against losing her. He sought help for her